Hey, good afternoon, everyone. We are on our final podcast on why the kids aren't growing up by Abigail Schreier, Bad Therapy. We'll tackle a little bit in each of the three or four chapters here, and then we'll give you any thoughts on to why you should read this book. If we haven't convinced you otherwise, you're probably not to be convinced. Chapter number 9 was the road paved by gentle parents. I didn't have a gentle parent. Jack didn't have a gentle parent. Steve didn't have a gentle parent. Darius didn't have a parent. Dad was gone. Yeah.
Well, before we jump to the gentle parents, you just want to say anything at all about chapter 8, the full empathy, mean as hell.
I was so uncomfortable saying that bad word, Mike.
I know. I took the brunt of it. Yeah.
My takeaway in that was, you know, we really needed to find empathy.
I agree.
Because, you know, everything she's talking about with these children that are being
empathetic.
That are being accused of being empathetic. They haven't really experienced what the other individual experienced.
They're being empathetic for these people groups
that they know really nothing about.
And they're weaponizing them against an individual. So, especially that's how the story started.
But that's the point to me. It's the abuse of empathy. To me, being empathetic is not bad.
No.
But they're weaponizing it.
Yes, that's the part that is bad. You know, this was the only part in the book so far that I thought that she was overstating.
For me, it would be more, you know, you can be sympathetic towards someone because I haven't walked in their shoes. So I can express sympathy. You know, if you're saying something mean or whatever about Darius, I mean, I can have sympathy for Darius, but unless you've done that to me, I don't really have empathy. But I know what you're saying. They're kind of hijacking a cause.
Mike, where does he take it to? Where does she take it too far?
So to me, I think she paints the picture in this chapter that being empathetic in and of itself is not good.
Mm. Almost to that point. I mean, so like she opens up with the idea that this this young Jewish girl is
top of her class, smart as a whip,
really quick witted.
Yeah,
and a couple of her friends, they're joking around and they made the poor choice of filming it, and then made the even poorer choice of posting it on social media. And she starts running down these trio of things that they can dress up for like Halloween or something.
Yeah.
And she makes the poor choice of just really running away with her imagination and getting silly with it. And one of them is like Jewish. Well, we could be a Jew and Hitler and something else to that effect. And of course, these other girls who I guess don't like her took it and said she's being racist.
Yeah. Moses, stuff. Jesus, Muhammad, slaves, indigenous people, and white settlers.
Yeah, and things of that nature. And the author took it and it rightly pointed out that was a weaponization of empathy, but then almost took it to the point of where if you're being, you got to be very careful about empathetic at all. Almost like if anybody is using empathy, you got to be careful that they're weaponizing empathy. And I wrote in the top of my margins is how does weep with those who weep fit for a Christian? You know, because we're told to do that. And I think that one of the people she interviewed kind of brought it back a little bit in the idea that we can only really truly have empathy for a select few people at a time that we know. And because we can't do it for large people groups. So, I mean, right now we can be sympathetic for the people of Western North Carolina, but we can't really be truly empathetic for them. But if one of you were hurting because you just found out that your wife had cancer, I could probably be more empathetic for you because you're very close to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess that was the point I was trying to make in the beginning.
Yeah. And that's where, to me, I saw it kind of getting hijacked, how sometimes people tolerance.
Yes.
you know, kind of can hijack that being tolerant with people, and they can hijack that in a bad way. But the point she makes in it on how people were going too far by weaponizing it, I totally agree with all of that.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that's basically the summary of that chapter. So,
yeah, that. And then, you know, she brought up that the school officials didn't even look into it. They just took the accusation and immediately just punished her because, well, we got complaints. So it doesn't matter what you meant, how you meant it, what was it was a joke, wasn't a joke, whatever. You know, we got 10 parents that are 10 students and parents that are pushing us hard. So we're just going to come down hard on you. And we don't care why.
And this chapter really hit home for me because being a school administrator, you
fall into that constantly.
I get this. Yeah. A lot. I get this all the time, or a lot of the times is I'll get a group of students or worse, parents. The parent part really hit when she got down to the bottom of 161 and she talks about the parent that brings those cachet of saved screenshots and things of that nature. I can't tell you the number of times I've had parents come in with 20, 30, 40 pages of printouts of screenshotted materials in a folder and just lay them out on my desk or on a conference room table and just page after page after page of screenshots going back years to prove their case. And
it's like, if it was that bad, why did you bring it up before now?
What it's usually of, and what it usually boils down to, is their child is the child that's probably one of the nicest kids in the school. And when you're looking at it, there's a lot of devil in disguise activity going on that you know about and you hear about, but you can't ever just point your finger on. And it was that paragraph that said, you know, be careful of the ones that are coming up and using this as a weapon, because usually they're using it as a weapon of bedlam, ethical bedlam, creating that thing. And I said, normally these are the actual devils in disguise. The more friendly a person is, the more you have to kind of watch your back, usually in the schoolhouse.
Yeah. We didn't have all the social media when I was in high school, but I can definitely remember one young man that had a knack of, you know, he could get, you know, say something to one person and kind of get them riled and be like, hey, Mike, you know, you know, Darius said this about you. And then Darius, Mike said this about you. And then he'd kind of get the two of you, pit you each against each other. And then you guys would get in a fist fight and he'd just kind of walk back and watch and be like, hey, teacher, they're fighting.
Yep.
And you know, so then, you know, you guys are getting punished and he's sitting there laughing like, ha ha, look what I did.
But really and truthfully, and then we've created this tattletale culture where for years we've told them, you know, instead of handling it yourself, you know, you don't need to get into a pushing match. You need to tell a teacher, you need to go find an authority. You need to do this. You need to do that, because we take two boys on the playground and we punish them to extremes for being boys and working it out. Or two girls who decide to work it out, or even better yet, sometimes a girl just lays a guy out, you know, and when they're of equal age in elementary school, and that happens, and we punish them to super extremes because today's society says that we have to, or the rules are set in such a way. And I'll be honest, I've been the dad at home and I've looked my girls in the eyes and I've told them, I said, you know, punch them, just hit them right in their square in their face.
Can you edit that out, please?
I don't know why you would want to, because it's called a self-correcting action. Sometimes that's what you have to do to the bully. And what that does is I say, you're going to get in trouble with the school. That's going to be the consequence of what it's going to take. But what's going to happen from it is they're going to learn that they don't mess with you. Mm. And that's the way we were raised. And you don't have to be a tattletale, because you will learn to solve your own problems that way.
Well, let's go from that transition there in chapter 9. starts off the, you know, the title, The Road Paved by Gentle Parents. And then she talks about how, you know, she grew up as a latchkey child.
That term, no one even talks about that term anymore, do they?
Oh, no. No, just...
That's gone.
Yeah. I mean, we have a family, you know, within the church that actually had to go through a process to get permission for their children
to be dropped off at the bus stop.
And
I had to prove that their kids were responsible. It was like incredible.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, this was me, you know, most of my life growing up, you know, you know, just go home and mom and dad would be home
when they got home,
you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock, you know, and I was on my own, but there were rules and parameters and, you know, it kept me in check most of the time.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Mike, in Japan, there are kids that walk themselves to school. Can you imagine that? They walk themselves to school. Who would let their kid walk to school today?
Today, very few.
Very few.
We have a few in the school.
Wow.
And you ought to hear the office. They're like, are we going to really let them do that? And I'm like, yeah. I was like, ask for a note from the parents. Put it in their file. Wow. And they're like, are you sure? Because, and I'm like, the parent is the parent. We got to know, the parent says that they can leave the school and walk themselves home. Let them walk themselves home. And we're talking seventh grade and above.
No, I'm talking about Japan.
I know.
First, second, third. It's incredible.
Oh, I get graders. It. I get it. But listen to what I'm saying. Our office is freaking out over a seventh grader.
Yeah, the whole world. Yep. All right. So what was the point of this chapter?
The point of this chapter is that the children rule. And it's normative for a child to bring a 35-year-old father to his knees with a tongue lashing.
Wow. Yeah, I think that, you know, she states, you know, the idea, the perspective of parents being categorized into permissive parents, authoritative parents, or authoritarian parents. And that neither of the extremes are where we need to be. We need to be in the middle. But sadly, in today's culture, we are almost every parent is in the permissive category.
Therapeutic.
Mm. Wow.
The idea that, we've tried to work with them on their feelings. We've tried to work with them on expressing their feelings properly. We've tried reasoning with them. We've tried rationalizing with them. We've tried everything but what I wrote on the top of 175. And just so you don't have to cut it out, I won't say it.
Mm. On 167.
But you could spell it.
Yeah, okay. Knock it off, shake it off. America once had a more masculine style of parenting. It's a style traditionally occupied by dad, though really I've seen women employ it to great effect. This is the style called knock it off, shake it off parenting. The sort that meant kids interpersonal conflict, work it out yourselves, greeted kids mishaps with you'll live, loving but stolid insistence that young children get back on the horse and carry it. Carry on. Mike, your dad on this?
Oh, most definitely. Yes, he was very much, you're okay.
You know, she said only the sadist would say shake it off with a broken limb or something to that effect. But how many of your football playing counterparts played with a broken limb before they realized it was broken? I can think of two or three.
I don't know that
you went to an incredible foot. I mean, just
they were
these football stories keep coming up.
I mean, serious. I just had dinner with a guy and he literally finished the football game because we only thought he had dislocated his wrist and they basically, you know, popped things back in alignment and it turned out to be a fracture.
I mean, I remember
a game
I can remember a game where Wesley Pope was concussed. And he came back into the huddle and he was not home. It was that bad, but he was still trying to play. Mm-hmm. And I had to escort him like off the field because, you know, but he was still in there. But no broken bones. I don't think I can ever say that.
There are stories though, Mike, where guys in the last phase of Ranger school will get hurt. And it is unbelievable what they, because they don't want to get recycled and have
they'll tape things up.
I remember a guy, he was in the snow phase or whatever when, anyway, but you know, he was running through and stepped in something because he didn't see the snow and broke his ankle or did something. And pretty much he wrapped it up and sucked it up and kept going because it's like you said, I mean, he didn't want to get recycled. And he said nobody would help him because he said, you know, nobody's allowed to help you. You're on your own. And guys were running past like, stinks to be you, dude. And
yeah,
but he just gutted it out.
But to get back to the book, just for clarification purposes,
why would we want
to
do that?
She's not saying that that's what parents should be doing to that extent.
No, she's not. No.
It's just, you know, if little things happen, you know, shake it off.
Okay. But to bring it back to the book, Mike, I suspect that guys that had that mental fortitude to be able to spend the last 3 days with a fracture to finish had a shake it off dad.
Yes.
That wasn't catering to them their whole life.
They were able to escalate what they had grown up under enough, that resilience.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, when I heard last week that 44 and under, the second leading death is suicide. I mean, that was just a shocking statistic for me. 44 and younger, number two killer is suicide. That's because we don't have a shake it off mentality in anything. Everything's devastating. I mean, there's nothing that isn't devastating.
But I think, you know, again, social media, I think, plays into that so much because you can't just make a mistake and then be forgotten. You know, it's, you know, like with young people, you know, that's they don't like your post or they're just reposting it and laughing at you and sending it to everybody in your school. And, you know, so it's not just, you know, I messed up one day and everybody laughed at me. And then, you know, 2 days later, they forgot about it. You know, now it's just constantly being thrown back in, you know, the students' faces over and over and over again.
Interesting because she seemed to start out the book kind of further zoomed out, talking about the overall effects of therapy in general and then the effects of, you know, bad therapy within the schools. And now she's getting, I think, down to the bedrock issue.
Who's
that
your parent?
Influence, that outside influence on parents is actually causing what we're seeing out further.
Right.
This whole idea of a knock it off, shake it off attitude, in conjunction with what she said previously about allowing kids the space to build resilience, I think that's why we have people who can soldier on through Ranger School or, like, you know, get rhabdo in selection and keep going because they didn't have those constraints growing up. They were told to figure it out. And that it's really a hindrance to have, you know, such a level of monitoring on kids to the point where they can't do for themselves.
Yeah, and that theme keeps coming through in the book over and over again, you know.
And I think that's where we can talk about, even when we were given space to figure things out, we didn't always figure them out in the best way at that season or that moment. But yet, it still helped us to develop those skills of processing and working through things.
Yeah.
That as we became more mature, then we had that to work it out. But we did it in a right way to not get in trouble or, you know, do anything wrong.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember the first real job I had where I had any supervisory responsibility, you know, it was, you know, we didn't have cell phones, none of that. And I remember my boss dropped me and the crew off to do work and we weren't really sure what to do. So, you know, everybody's saying, what do we do? And I'm like, I'm not sure. So we just kind of sat around and waited for him to come back.
How'd that work out for you?
Not very well. He wasn't real happy. And, you know, he was like, what's everybody standing around for? And I was like, well, we weren't sure what to do. And he was like, well, didn't you just, you can't just make a decision. And I was like, well, I didn't want to make a wrong decision. He was like, Steve, he said, I'd rather you just make an admin decision, even if it's wrong, and move forward than not make any decision. Because that's always wrong. He was like, at least if you made a decision, we could work with it and, you know, adjust. But, you know, he said, just, you know, having four guys stand around getting paid for nothing. He was like, that's totally unacceptable.
Yep. I'd rather you do more work than was necessary than no work at all.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Yep. You know, so from that point forward, it was, you know, I'm going to make an admin call and we're going to roll with it. And then if he came back and it was like, well, you know, and there were times, well, I'd rather you had done this or, you know, next time, well, let's do it this way. But at least it was something he could work with and roll with.
So as we move, you know, continuing past the knock it off and the shake it off,
yeah,
and continue with the authoritative style of parenting, then she moves into spanking. You know, and on 190, you know, she's.
Did you already do the three parenting styles?
Yeah, the permissive, the authoritative, and the authoritarian.
Yeah,
and that neither of the extremes are what she thinks is needed or was provided the best results over the decades.
Yeah, I like the authoritative.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so, but then on 190, she's checking resource studies, and she says studies have been unable to support supposed links between spanking and externalizing disorders, because many want to say, you know, parents that spank actually damage their children. But she's documenting studies here that there have never been any studies that have.
What page are you
proved
on?
On 190.
At the top there.
Yeah, that first paragraph.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but there's never been any studies that proved any link of causality between spanking and creating disorders within children.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, they would have to go through and really define spanking, you know, and how it's done. You know, there's a difference in, you know, chasing the kid around the house with a switch or whatever, and just, you know, as they're running around in circles, wailing at them, as opposed to, you know, sitting down, explaining, you know, what did you do wrong? Why is this wrong? You know, how does it conflict with what we're taught in scripture? You know, so now this is your punishment, you know, let's move on.
Yes, there's a difference between spanking, whipping, and beating.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're advocating for spanking.
And we're advocating for the corporal punishment, spanking. Mm-hmm.
That's done appropriately, yeah, and properly.
One or two, maybe.
Darius, when you were in school, did they spank?
Oh, absolutely. In school?
When you were in school, did they spank?
The teachers did not. No. I got sent home with a note, and then I had to switch off the mandatory and back.
Right. So they were done when you were in school. Yeah. Mike, were
they elementary spanked? School.
In elementary school.
But by the time I got to junior high, it was allowed. But I do not remember anybody in junior high or high school getting it ever.
Ooh, I do.
You remember hearing about kids that yeah. school near getting
up. My school wasn't as tough as that Arkansas school.
Well, there's a lot of difference between Arkansas and Pennsylvania as far as, I mean, north versus the south and behind.
But I remember it. I never got one in elementary school. I was too smart for that.
We had a coach named Stan Brown, and our principal was kind of squirrely. So, Coach Stan Brown gave all the whippings. And if you had a choice between Stan Brown and a 3-day suspension, I've seen many a lineman and linebackers take a 3-day suspension over getting licks from Coach Brown.
Yeah. I was in West Virginia in middle school, and they were still paddling in seventh grade. Was just part of the culture, and behind the teacher's desk was the paddle hanging on the wall.
Yep.
And it was just understood that that was one of the ways that you could get disciplined.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, having been in teaching decades ago, I would hear teachers decrying, oh, we should bring it back. But even at that point, when I started teaching, the culture of parents and the family life
right.
had changed already to this point that would never have flown because what she's talking about had already started in the 90s when I first started teaching.
But I mean, there's no behavior that I've had to deal with in the classroom that I thought was worthy of a spanking. And maybe I get a greater degree of respect than other teachers would be, but there hasn't been anything. In your year last year, Darius, was there anything that you dealt with that?
Not that was, granted, I was with 10th and 11th graders.
Right.
But at that age, really, spanking didn't mean a whole lot to most of them. Very rare would I say there was any behavior, like, you know, a couple times, you know, boys saying really inappropriate things to girls. To me, that doesn't line up.
Yeah. Sure.
With my own child, appropriate age, and explain that this is not how I speak. A girl who's created in God's image, she's a daughter of God, addressed her that way.
But. I know, even. I'm trying to remember, were we still paddling, Jack, when not when you were teaching, not when you became head of school, but
when I was teaching? Yes.
Okay. We would still paddle.
It was on its way out.
Okay.
When I first arrived.
Yeah. But I mean, even then, I mean, you know, it would have to be like a suspendable offense today. You know, they cheated on a test. You know, they were defiant to a teacher. They were fighting. And really,
I think it was only a year or two, and then it was the parent
had to come in and do the paddle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even that, it was more, and I think a teacher was only allowed to do two swats with a ping pong paddle. But
when I got here, only the principal could.
Okay, it had moved to that. But I mean, you know, the mindset there was the deterrent of, you know, all the student, you know, everybody in the class knows, you know, when, you know, you cheated on a test and the teacher says, you know, Mike, I need to see you in the hallway. It was kind of like, okay, everybody knows what's happening to Mike.
Okay. So
the deterrent was, if I cheat and get caught, I'm going to get the same thing.
So let me clarify, you know, a moment ago I said, you know, I had never gotten spanked at school. Needless to say, there were, we'll say, a few times that I got in trouble at school that I then did get spanked at home, though. And my parents came to school and they backed the teacher and they backed the principal on every situation. And then I got home and got spanked. And then I got asked what actually happened.
Oh, yeah. Afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards.
My mom taught at the school I went to, and there were times that the teacher would tell my mom something I did and she'd spank me. And then when I'd get home, my dad would go, "You got spanked at school today." I'm like, "No." "Well, that's not what your mother said." And I was like, "Well, mom spanked me. Well, was she at school?" "Yes." "Okay, you're getting another one." It was like, man, that's like a cheap
double jeopardy right there. Huh?
That's a cheap shot. Yeah. But
and that's why Steve is who he is today. All right. Anything else on this spank? Because we're not going to convince anyone to spank on this.
Yeah, no.
No,
they're not
good. Yeah.
No, not at all.
On the top page 190, what actually makes for miserable kids? Placing them in charge, failing to hold their behavior to high standards, and not punishing them when they deliberately allow their behavior to fall short. And yes, according to Pomeran, what else makes for an unhappy kid? Parents behaving in a consistently affirmative manner toward the child's impulse, desires, and actions. But I think she's touching on something without saying it overtly. This is kind of the tension in a household, especially as a godly parent, where we're balancing the tension of, okay, spare the rod and spoil the child, as well as fathers don't exasperate children. And I think, you know, when we allow children to get up into this position that they're never meant to be in, they need to learn to respect authority, whether thankfully it's agreed upon or not. That is a way to demonstrate that authority, so as accountability. So I think she hits the nail.
Yeah, that. And then on page 191, she says, worst of all, the children don't believe that we can help them. We don't make them feel secure because we've told them over and over, or expressed in so many ways, that we're scared out of our minds and we aren't actually in charge.
You know, the ones that I've seen turn the corner the most in the academy are the ones that come in with no understanding of discipline. And they're in like seventh or eighth grade, maybe ninth. And you're working with them and they're in trouble. I mean, they get in trouble for like normal kid stuff. Nothing overly wrong, just it disrupts the classroom. And so, and they do it frequently enough that they elevate themselves. Now they're seeing the principal or the disciplinarian authority. And so they're in my office and I'm working with them, and we're taking the time to explain why you can't be that way, how it disrupts things. Mm-hmm. And you're giving them an understanding of, because you know, they've never had this before. And you're doing that. And the ones that are responsive, you want to spend more time with. So you're spending time with them. And then you come in on days and you see them and they come in the school and they're just having a bad day. You see it from the first time they come in the hallway or whatever.
Yeah.
And you pull them in and you just don't even let them go to class yet. And you spend time with them praying and let them know that they're just loved.
Yeah.
and you do that with them and you show them a different side of you, you're not just a disciplinarian, you're also an adult that cares for them, loves them, and wants them to have well. And then they come in later that day because of something, and you know it's because of the morning they've had, and you excuse it. And you don't really excuse it. You say, I can understand why it happened, so I'm not going to hold this one against you. It doesn't mean that you did right, but we're not going to put this one on your record. But I want you to go back to class. I want you to do right.
And that's right. And you have to learn your students. I mean, I remember years and years ago.
You're treating them like your own child.
Right. But I remember I had a girl, she literally would come in at 6 o'clock from before care, stay till 6 o'clock. And I knew she didn't have to. I mean, she could have gone home. But one day she was crying and, I called her in and I was like, what's going on? I was like, why are you just hanging out and you can go home? And she goes, I don't want to go home. I don't like to be home. And I was like, and that was foreign to me. And I was like, what do you mean you don't like to go home? And she's like, well, I never know what guy's going to be at my house with my mom. And, started explaining her life or her home situation. And it was just like, your heart breaks and you're like, poor ninth grade kid, like no wonder why you don't want to leave.
Right.
At least here you have some
stability
and love. And yeah, you act up or act out.
Structure. Yeah.
And, she was like, it's a miserable home life.
And that leads us right into the next section. Well, there. It's
spare the rod. Chapter spare the rod, drug the child. And what we're talking about is the rod of discipline, but also the rod that the shepherd used to comfort as well.
But even before we move into chapter 10 there, what you guys described as a positive experience that she points out in the book, this is why a lot of kids are going into extremist groups, because they're looking for structure. They're looking for people to give them boundaries. And since their parents never did it, they're willing to go into very extreme groups just to get that structure and those boundaries. And so the story that you, Jack, and that Steve, you were talking about, you did it in the right way that we need to be doing it. And that saved a kid, I would like to think, from looking further, in a bad organization, extreme organization.
Yeah, I was going to add, Mike, not just structure, but purpose.
Yes.
I think it's why the army does. Living. I think it's why some of the most
best soldiers.
Some of the best soldiers, lifelong soldiers, you might even say, career soldiers, are ones that were so anti-authority in school, end up in the military, and make some of the best soldiers.
And those guys, though, Jack, when the military's done. Like they have nothing sometimes, 30 years of service, 35 years. And then now what, because they built their life.
Their life falls apart and they have no purpose. And
I mean, it's just like a pitiful scenario,
And so that's where the line's in the middle again.
Mm-hmm.
We need to help them have that and develop that, but then to be able to transition that into the next chapter of their life, purpose and structure.
Well, I think that's why the church is so important.
Yeah, right. Absolutely, Jack. Absolutely.
But Jack, as you're saying, chapter 10 is spare the rod, drug the child.
Yeah, and we're talking about how the rod can what I was alluding to is how the rod can be used both discipline and comfort, because the shepherd's rod was used both ways. And I think she alludes to that in this chapter. As I looked at it with my trying to read my Christian filter through all of this secular stuff within it.
And I think, a big example is the one that starts there in 198 and over on to 199, where there's this doctor,
Ophir.
Thank you so much. And he was giving out drugs for ADHD children years until his own son, got diagnosed with ADHD. And then now he thought through it from a different perspective. And he ended up researching it and digging in. And what they ended up doing was creating a very discipline structure for their son with allowances of some lateral movement. And they gave him purpose in the chores and activities that they were presenting in front of him. And he was still being able to be a boy, but yet overarchingly, he was able to move forward and do well in school and not act out.
Yeah, it's but what they do is that's what we automatically do is we take a lot of the things that studies have come out and they said, okay, in true ADHD, ADD, and they used to separate them, ADD, and then you had HD. They find that usually girls are ADD predominant and boys are HD predominant. But because HD, hyperactivity, does lead to some attention deficit, they'll put them both together now in a lump sum group of ADHD because girls also have this ADD. Mm-hmm. Attention deficit disorder where they daydream but they're not hyperactive. So they've tried to create this middle ground or lump sum difference and they just treat to the middle. And the only way they can do that is to throw drugs at it. And truthfully, drugging isn't really the solution. It's the ability to slow down all the stimuli to help them focus on one.
And we talked about it in previous chapters that sadly parents are finding relief in this because now it's something that they can use to help their children, but it's really not helping their children. Like you said, Jack. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, the severity may call for medication.
There is a spectrum. But like you said, treating towards the middle is the norm now versus trying to qualify, okay, this is somebody that's at level 10 extreme.
That could use some training, and this is somebody that could use, we're going to need medication.
At least for a time.
So that we can control to train.
Yeah.
So I guess you guys know that our son took medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we were one of the, parents that drugged our kid. But our first experience with it was when Austin was 4.5. And we couldn't go anywhere. We couldn't come to your house. He would be jumping off your cabinets. He would be just off the walls. Our fun time was when we could go in the woods, when we could go somewhere where he could just not be. This was DeRidder, Louisiana. We'd never make it through a worship service without getting buzzed out, called out, never, ever. Throwing things, breaking glass. I mean, it was insane. And so we finally succumbed to medication. And the very first time that he took that medication and it began to work on his neurological system, I didn't know who this boy was. It was yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And like everything that we've been pouring into him for 4 years was there. He just didn't know how to put it together. And so there are some scenarios where parents can get, honestly, relief.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because there's a spectrum of where children are. I think what she's arguing is...
I concur.
Yeah.
I concur. But I'm just trying to make sure if there's one family out there on the podcast, we're not bringing down condemnation on...
Yes.
Well, we would get up very early in the morning, eat breakfast, take his medication, and do homework. Because at 9 o'clock at night, there was no ability to do math. There was no ability to focus. We just needed to go to bed and start early in the morning. And we lived this out for a very, Harry, it was exhausting. It was, that's why we only had one child. It was just utterly. So people like this that write these books, and you know, I'm the one that said we should read this book. They have to be careful.
And I think we should go ahead and move into, you know, the next little section in this chapter where she addresses anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
Because I think that goes along the same lines that there are people that have a level of anxiety and depression that medication can help them work through it. And we're not talking against that. We're just talking about throwing medication at everybody that might not even be on that spectrum.
As if it's an absolute cure-all.
Yeah. And so, yes, we definitely do not want to hurt anybody by saying that they should never.
Yeah, but right. And I think, though, I think the mindset today is if I have any anxiety,
I have to have medication.
I have to take my pill, or I have to get a pill, or if I have any amount of depression, I need something, as opposed to like what she brought out that, you know, anxiety and depression are helpful.
Well,
it helps us learn to cope with things.
Okay, so let's say that we need that in our lives. Well, let's say that there's seven indicators for ADHD. There's seven indicators for anxiety. There's seven indicators for depression. And I'm just picking a random number. I'm just picking a random number. And you show two, Mike shows six, and I show six. Me and Mike might need medication for any one of those because we're showing six. But because you show two and we show six, they give all of us medication. That's what we're speaking against. We're not talking about the two people that show six or five, even that there's a point in which medication is needed. Or there's a biochemical thing or a neuro thing in our bodies that's causing the five or the six, or something's out of balance and it needs to be regulated, and it's only going to be regulated by medicine. And with that regulation, you're going to be a normal person. But then there's others where you have momentary periods in which, you know what, something did happen in your life and you are depressed for X number of weeks. Because it happened, or you know what, you foresee this thing coming, and it is creating anxiety because you know it's going to be difficult and hard or tragic.
Yeah,
you know, like I can't imagine if my mother went through. I got told today she has dementia. That would create a sense of anxiety in my life, and I would begin to show markers of anxiety. Does that mean I need medication for it? Maybe not. Does that mean I might need to be talking to some friends? Yeah, probably so.
Right.
I probably need to increase my prayer life? Yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
To keep it under control.
And I think it depends on each individual's personality. I would have more the personality to be more prone to become anxious over situations. You know, I have the tendency to think, you know, well, what if this happens, or you know, this could happen, and if I'm not careful, I can get worked up over that and get very anxious about it. Same with depression. You know, if there's a series of things in my perception that have gone wrong or aren't going quite right, my tendency is to start withdrawing and
getting very down.
And, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, not clinically depressed, but you know, I would say that there have been several times in my life where, you know, I've struggled with that.
If you were at a therapist, he might declare you depressed.
Yes. If I was at the doctor and they went through the mental health questions and I answered honestly to all of them, they'd probably be, you know, sending me off to the psych ward at that.
Well, maybe not, but they might give you some medication to help you out for a while.
But, you know, but I think, you know, I think that depends on our, you know, our individual makeup and how God's designed us, not to blame him for it, but, you know, our personalities.
Why don't we pull it to a close? Let's go around the table. Everybody, you know, give us your closing thought on what you got out of the book, why you think somebody should or shouldn't read it.
Well, I like part three. It just says there's nothing wrong with our kids. So I'd go with that one.
There you go.
There's nothing wrong with my girls. They're good.
I would agree. Steve's girls are amazing. I would say that parenting is the hardest job that you can do in life. And this book would encourage you to get back to parenting.
Darius, what do you think?
I would say this is a very clear and present reminder of why, as parents, we need to
be ready. Okay. All right. Jack, what do you think?
You know, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you're going through, the book is a reminder that it's not you and you're not to own it. In the essence of somebody else's wrong isn't meant for you to wear in your feelings. Stop doing that. Stop taking ownership for what others feel in the essence of that. I don't think that's what the Bible meant by to carry each other's burdens. And a lot of us carry anxiety or shame or guilt or some other thing that leads to these perceptions of depression or anxiety or fear or whatever it is, or society's perceptions, and we begin to feel shame that we're not doing well enough as parents, grandparents, because somebody's putting something on us. And that's not what it means by bear each other's burdens. You don't have to wear those. What it means is if you see a brother in need, go help out that need, but don't wear something that you were never supposed to wear. And that this book is a good reminder of that.
Yeah. And seriously, my takeaway, I mean, she opened my eyes to several things. It's amazing how many conversations I've had since we started reading this book that I've been able to share with people. I know of at least two people that have bought the book and have been reading it, you know, just because it's come up in either Sunday school or my Wednesday night group and conversations on that. But, you know, the realization that not every child is the same, you know, we can't just treat them all as robotic or stamp, you know, rubber stamps, mm-hmm. you know, they're each one's different and they have to be looked and treated differently. And the parents need to be the ones that truly take that responsibility and onus of, you know, I need to learn how to parent and not just hand that over to a therapist or a pediatrician or somebody else. But I take the responsibility for my children, and I'm going to parent them and learn how to parent them. And, you know, yeah, I'm going to make mistakes, but, you know, as Jack said, I'm going to seek advice. I'm going to seek scripture, my pastor, you know, reach out to someone that's doing it well, and get advice and help, and not just take the easy route, as Darius, you mentioned earlier, just, you know, I'm at my wit's end. So just whatever, so I can have a break.
I think we would all recommend the book. You'll get different things out of it. We will be off next week because it is our annual men's retreat down at Camp Anchorage, and it will start off Thursday evening, all day Friday and Saturday through lunchtime. And so if you are a guy here in Berean and you're listening to this, hopefully you will be there for that time. And we will get back with you then as podcasts in a couple weeks. Thank you for listening.